Good afternoon, Scott Spears, along with you today on the Now program for the next two solid hours. 15 minutes past the hour, and we have got a program today. If you are interested in news and you are interested in legendary newsmen, this is the place to be. Now, let me tell you what's coming up next hour, really quick. Next hour, we're going to be joined by legendary newsman, longtime ABC News White House correspondent, co-anchor of Primetime Live, the primetime news magazine for so many years, and also co-host of This Week with Sam and Koki, Sam Donaldson, next hour to give his thoughts on everything going on in the world at this particular juncture, and it is an interesting world to say the least. Now, this hour, we're joined by another legendary newsman. He is the author of a new book, Enemy of the People, Trump's War on the Press, the New McCarthyism, and the Threat to American Democracy. He's a former host of Meet the Press, one of Edward R. Murrow's boys. What a pleasure it is always to welcome to these microphones Marvin Kalb. Marvin, how are you?
I'm just fine, Scott. Nice to be with you.
Always good to be with you. Marvin, how did this book come about?
It came about because on February 17th, 2017, about 3 weeks after President Trump took the oath of office, I was supposed to do a speech at the Cosmos Club, which is an eating club here in Washington, D.C., and that evening, and a friend of mine at the White House, I still have a few there, called me and said, I know that you're going to be doing a speech tonight about the press and about President Trump. You ought to know that tonight he's going to be calling the press the enemy of the people. And I said, what's that? He said, yes, he's going to be calling the American press the enemy of the people. I said, that's absurd. He said, yes, but that's what he's going to be doing. And so I rewrote the lead of the speech, delivered the speech. It came as a shock, not only to the people in the audience, but also to me in a very serious way, because the phrase enemy of the people and my own experience related to something I heard in 1956 when I was a young attaché at the United States Embassy in Moscow, working for the State Department, the middle of the Cold War. I spoke Russian, I taught Russian history, I sort of knew about Russia, and Nikita Khrushchev, who was then the leader of the Soviet Union, was delivering a speech on February 24th, as I recall, 1956, in which he denounced the legend of Joseph Stalin. That was, Scott, a very big deal in the Soviet Union, because Stalin for 29 years had been the unquestioned dictator in that country. And then suddenly here was the next communist leader, Khrushchev, denouncing the former communist leader. And those of us in the diplomatic world at that time were fascinated that one communist would attack another, and in the following way would the attack go. One of the major reasons he was attacking Stalin, he said, was that Stalin continued to call critics of his rule, journalists generally, writers, dissidents, he was calling them enemies of the people, and Khrushchev thought that that was a horrible expression to call one person who was a totally dedicated Russian nationalist, to call him an enemy of the people. Why would Stalin do that? This was very much in my mind, that here was an American president, not a communist, not a fascist, nothing like that at all, but an American president calling the American press enemies of the people. And my mind went back to Khrushchev and Stalin, and I'm thinking, one communist attacks another communist because he doesn't like the latter's use of the term enemy of the people. And now we jump way ahead, 50 years or so, and an American president is using that expression. I was shocked.
Mm. Marvin, you've covered a lot of presidents, and one of the interesting things that when it comes to this president, do you think this president is covered differently than other presidents have been?
I think at the very beginning, the answer is probably yes, but it goes way back to the campaign. In 2015, when at that time the candidate, Donald Trump, walked down a flight of steps in the Trump Tower in Midtown Manhattan, and he announced that he would like to be our president, he began to use odd expressions in his speech pattern. And he began to talk about Mexicans being rapists. And that was sort of a shocking thing to say about Mexicans, but he said it. And then during the campaign itself, he began to use a lot of expressions and began to take a lot of positions that were strange. However, they were making news, and by that I mean anybody, you don't have to be a presidential candidate, anybody who says something truly unusual is going to make news. People will listen to that person. But when you're running for president and you begin to say things that are rather odd, that really shock the system, that takes American policy, let us say, toward the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and begins to talk about NATO as if it's an antique organization that ought to be dumped, that is a news story. And he began to say one thing after another, so he got twice as much free time on radio and television than the opposing candidate, Hillary Clinton, got. And on cable television news, Trump was running away with commentators spending much more time talking about him than talking about Clinton. And that normally costs a great deal of money. He was getting it free. And I thought myself, looking back upon it now, that was bad journalism, that you're supposed to cover both candidates roughly in the same way. There used to be a rule, in fact, that you had to have equal time for competing points of view, but that's no longer the case. And so Trump dominated the amount of space, the amount of airtime, and he was doing it essentially free of charge. Clinton was being clobbered in that way. But I thought, you're asking me what I thought. I thought at the time that it was bad journalism, and some of that has continued, but the press, for the most part, is beginning to turn around now and do much more vigorous and deep reporting.
It's interesting, Marvin, because we look back at the history of electronic journalism, for sure. And it's a very short period of time in the grand scheme of things.
Yes.
And the funny thing about it is for the longest time, up until the 1980s, you had three broadcast channels who usually delegated one nightly newscast. All the networks didn't even have morning shows at that point. They certainly all
did. No, Scott, I think if I may, NBC had the Today Show. That was on from the very late 1940s. That is one of the old classic programs. NBC did have a morning show.
But in the beginning, it was kind of, they had a monkey on there, and really wasn't a hard news show.
It was not serious news, but they did have what they called a news program, at any case.
Absolutely. But here came cable. And in the early 2000s, here came two more for CNN first in the 80s, and they had it for a long time. And then here comes Fox News in the early 2000s, and here comes MSNBC. Now you have news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on three channels, and they claim to be news. Do you consider any of those channels news?
That's an interesting question. In a way, I consider all three of them to be news programs, yes. But they approach their responsibilities in different ways. My own opinion, and that's all it is that of the three of them, CNN sticks as close as it can to the middle of the road, and it tends to try to be objective about the news. It may fail every now and then, but it makes an effort to be fair. Fox News is very often can only be described as a propaganda arm of the Republican Party. It does essentially whatever it is that the president wants. Only occasionally do you hear a whisper of criticism on Fox about things that President Trump does or says. As far as MSNBC is concerned, it appears very definitely to shift toward the left side of the spectrum and presents a point of view which could be called and is often called a liberal point of view. But it tries as best it can to stick to the news. Fox quite often ignores the news if it gets in the way of what it takes to be the proper political line.
That being said, what does it say that MSNBC is now the number one rated cable network? Before that, Fox had it for 17 years. And the network, as you describe, as being the most accurate most of the time and fair, is always in dead last place.
It's an interesting point you're making, and that points to the importance of ratings as a way of determining how much money you make. And the amount of money that you make is the measuring stick for determining popularity. And let me try to explain that. When Fox got started in 1996, it was the same year in which MSNBC got started. But Fox was run by a man who was extraordinarily intelligent about public opinion and the maneuvering of public opinion, the manipulation of public opinion. And his name was Roger Ailes. He's no longer with us. He died a couple of years ago. But Roger was a genius at figuring out how to get an audience. And he got an audience at Fox by figuring out that there are a lot of people in this country who are unhappy, who felt that the Vietnam War was not a lost war, but a war that was lost by the liberal press. And he began to feed this unhappiness with news that fit their predetermined point of view. And what he found was that a lot of people were unhappy, had that point of view, and wanted to hear it on air, wanted it to be justifiably presented as news. And that's what Fox did. And by the time Fox was 4.5 years old, at the time of the 2000 presidential campaign, it was already number one among the cable operators. And it was only much, much later, in recent years, with the arrival of President Trump, that MSNBC began to move up the scale of ratings and challenge Fox. And now they're about even, with one week being ahead of the other, but it more or less they're about the same. And you're absolutely right that CNN, which does make a determined effort to be down the middle as best it can, ends up making the least amount of money. However, let's not be sorry for them. In 2016, during the presidential campaign, CNN made more money by covering a lot of Trump than it had ever made before. $1 billion, which is B, $1 billion was what CNN earned. So it's nice to see that they came in third, but they came in and made a ton of money in the process.
You know, it's interesting, Marvin, because I go back to the 60s, and a lot of people don't remember this. When Phil Donahue's talk show started, it was a very serious show. I remember Fred Friendly, legendary CBS newsman, said that Phil Donahue was the new Edward R. Murrow. He would have Sam Shepard on for an hour. He could do things that the networks couldn't do at that time. Majority Lip, Minority Whip would be on his show. And then the 80s came, and a flood of other talk shows similar to Phil Donahue's, but with different, more comical, I guess, takes came, and Phil Donahue had to change because he could not be number one by putting Bob Dole on for an hour. Was that the deterioration of news as being a truthful vehicle to the American people electronically?
That's a powerful question that you're raising, Scott, because it really goes to the heart of the current problem with American journalism. Donahue was a representative of the beginning of the major change that took place. The changes that took place started in roughly the 1980s. They were pushed along dramatically in the 1990s. And then when we got into the internet age, and I'm going to call that the 21st century, news was profoundly changed by the forces unleashed by the internet. And they were manifest in two ways. One was in the underlying financial backing of a news program. And the other was in the technological changes that were seen. Because of the technology, things began to move so rapidly that you did not have time for the kind of hour that Phil Donahue would give you. There was an impression that you had to rush along, because with the ability to do something live, with the ability to cover the Iraq war live, or the Afghanistan war live, you made it seem as if it was an adventure story. It was not news. It was an adventure. You were part of an adventure, and you wanted to watch it. And it was not because you wanted to find out what was happening so much as you wanted to find out how this story ended. And you went from one dramatic story to another, carried live. And when you carry something live, and you know this, Scott, because you're on live all the time, you say something and you're out there. You don't have a chance to edit what you're saying, to rewrite what you're saying, to rethink something that you're saying. You just say it, and it's out there, and it's live, and people latched on to that. And when you were doing these live, quote, analysis pieces, you had better be right, because if you said something wrong, you had said it, it was out there, there was nothing you could do to call it back. That ability for everything to be conveyed almost as an entertainment program then had a profound change ultimately upon the public's judgment of the news. And they began to think that all news had to be quick and flashy and exciting, not realizing that when you go through a day, There are many times in the day when things are not that exciting and don't deserve to be the lead story on a news program, but they're put there because the people who do this are professionals of the highest quality, and they know that what you want is drama and excitement, sex, if at all possible, a drama, calamity. And so you are given that, and you don't have chances any longer for the hour-long Phil Donahue or Ed Murrow-type program.
It's interesting. Something during the 2016 presidential election that struck me and I thought did not get a lot of talk was we went through the campaign, and yes, cable news did carry Donald Trump, candidate Trump at that time, more than Hillary Clinton for the reasons you've explained. But when we got to the fall, when we got to that first presidential debate, it was interesting to me. The debate format was the same as it had always been. It was covered on the same channels that it had always been. It was two candidates as it had always been. But the most watched presidential debate in the history of presidential debates. Now, does that ultimately end up being a good thing because more people are watching democracy in action? Or do people really take anything away from those debates anymore?
Well, that's another one of your good questions, and I am not sure what the answer is, except one thing I am certain about, and it is, again, one of the reasons I wrote the book, Enemy of the People. I want people to understand that Donald Trump is a very unique political personality. He understands public relations very well. He believes that all things, all policy matters, are issues of public relations, about how you win over someone's approval and endorsement. And the American people are hooked. It's almost a kind of drug. They are hooked on the kind of personality that Trump exhibits, especially on television. And there is a group of Americans, the numbers are hard to nail down, but it's roughly 30-35% of the American people who have attached themselves to the Trump phenomenon and believe that it's God's gift to American politics. That leaves about 65% who do not agree with that point of view. And that 65% breaks down. And you get people who are very definitely Democratic and have always voted Democratic. And then you get an increasingly large number in the middle of independent voters. They are, based on the most recent off-year election, they are increasingly unhappy with Trump, and that accounts for the fact that the House of Representatives is now in Democratic hands, not Republican hands. That also accounts for the fact that Trump, in the midst of this governmental shutdown, that he once said he would proudly endorse, and in fact inaugurate, the people are now turning against the president and not supporting his position on the shutdown. So things are beginning to change, but the change is happening, I think, quickly, but nevertheless it may appear day to day to be slowly, but it is happening. And Trump, the phenomenon of Trump is beginning to fray at the edges. If we had, in other words, a vote right now, a national vote on the presidency, given what happened just last November, I would reckon that Trump would lose, and lose rather dramatically. But he is the president and will be the president until he isn't.
We're talking with legendary newsman Marvin Kalb. Next hour, another legendary newsman, Sam Donaldson. Marvin's new book is Enemy of the People, Trump's War on the Press, the New McCarthyism, and the Threat to American Democracy. Marvin, what's the New McCarthyism?
The New McCarthyism is a play on, obviously, the old one. And the old one goes back to those folks in your audience who are not familiar with Joseph McCarthy. He was a senator from Wisconsin. He was elected to the Senate in 1946. In 1950, he delivered a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, which was totally fabricated. He said that he had in his hand a list of 205 communists who were at the State Department. That was absolutely idiotic. There was no such thing. It was backed up by no evidence whatsoever, but he said it, and it was reported. And because he was a senator, and because we were in the middle of the Cold War at that time, what he said about communists being in the State Department or at the White House or at the Pentagon was news, except it wasn't true. But he paralyzed the country, and he was an effective speaker, and the country was sort of hunkered down into fear about communism, and they felt that we were being overwhelmed by communists, which simply wasn't true. But there were so many people who were frightened by the prospect of communism, the idea that there it was in Russia, and there it was in 1949, it was in China, and it was going to spread all over the world. Well, for a time it looked that way, but this was a lousy system of government. It couldn't do anything right except build big missiles. And the American people were traumatized by this personality who lied constantly. And finally, it took Edward R. Murrow, the great reporter for CBS, to do a series of programs on McCarthy, one on March 9, 1954, that I urge your listeners to go to their iPhones and watch that program. It's a fantastic show, in which Murrow pointed out time and time again that McCarthy was a liar, that McCarthy's position was based on totally false information, and that we should not take it that seriously. And the Republican leadership in the Senate at that time, not now, at that time, was so frightened of McCarthy that they wouldn't do anything against him unless the press moved. And the press did move, led by Murrow. And finally, McCarthy, at the tail end of 1954, was sanctioned by the Senate in what it is that he was doing. And finally, he died a year or two after that. He was an alcoholic. But most importantly, he was a liar who captivated for a brief period of time the nation and left us limp, weak, frightened. And for me, the new McCarthyism is some of the things that President Trump has managed to do in his 2+ years in office.
That being said, is there an Edward R. Murrow today? Is there an effect that could change this?
No. Unfortunately, in my judgment, there is no Edward R. Murrow today. There are many wonderful journalists. I love them all, but there is no Ed Murrow today. There is no person who has that kind of clout. Think about, for a second, Scott, think about Walter Cronkite, another CBS anchorman. When Walter in the 1960s and early 70s was doing his reporting in the midst of a tumultuous time in American history, the Vietnam War, the Black Revolution, all kinds of things were going on, Walter Cronkite was voted by 82% of the American people to be the most trusted man in America. Now, I want to be careful here. They didn't say the most trusted journalist. They said the most trusted man in America. Today, I ask your listeners, today, could you imagine that a journalist would be considered the most trusted man in America? Not at all. The industry itself has changed so dramatically that the idea of journalism being the place where you're going to find the most respected people is simply wrong. And that's most unfortunate, but unfortunately it's true.
Marvin, you still know people at the White House and stay connected to journalism.
Not many these days. A few.
With this Mueller report, which some people think is coming soon, some people think it's going to be a little longer, we now know that President Trump's campaign manager at the time gave polling data to the Russians. We don't know what he got in return. We don't know what they did with it. Is this Mueller report going to be a big thing, or is it just going... So I heard somebody refer to it the other day as, we know everything already and it's going to be anticlimactic. How do you see it?
I don't believe it'll be anticlimactic. I do believe it's going to contain a great deal of extremely damaging information about the president and what he did before he became president and since he's been president. Let me put it this way. I would entertain the possibility of it being anticlimactic if President Trump treated it in that way. He knows a lot about what it is that Mueller knows. He knows what Mueller and his people have come up with. Not all of it, but a lot of it. Because there is an exchange of information between Mueller lawyers, White House lawyers. There is, I don't know how much, but there is an exchange. Now, if the president felt that Mueller was going to produce nothing, really, a foul ball as opposed to a home run, he wouldn't be as nervous and excited about Mueller as he is these days. And as he has been since Mueller was first started in the spring of 2017. No, I think more than likely, Mueller is going to come in with an extremely devastating critique of our president. And then the story begins to unfold in the most dramatic way. How does the government of the United States respond to a devastating critique by the special counsel? Does it ignore it? No, you can't do that. The press will continue to run with it. The American people will be interested in it. What then does the Republican Senate do? I go back to McCarthy. The reason in the book I have a long chunk in there about McCarthy and Murrow, and the reason for that is that there is a frightening similarity between the inactive, terrified Republican Senate leadership during McCarthy's period and exactly what we see today. A Senate leadership on the Republican side that is frightened, that walks around like a small puppy on a leash behind President Trump. And that is a sorry thing to say, and I take no pleasure saying it, believe me. But what will that Republican Senate leadership do? Will it ignore it? Can't. How does it respond? Supposing the President of the United States were to say, ladies and gentlemen, I have said in the past that Mueller is a hoax and that all of the people who work for him are Democratic thugs. I'm quoting the president now. He didn't make these lines up. And that all of it is a lie. Everything you have just heard that he said is not true. There's going to be that 30 to 35% of the American people. There's going to be Fox News. There's going to be Rush Limbaugh. There's going to be this universe of right-wing media that is going to go along with that. And so what happens then? And that is my question, and I don't have an answer. But we have never, as a society, been as shaken as we are right now. I remember something that Scott McMurrow told me years ago. I once asked him, I think I have this in the tail end of the book, in fact. I once asked him, what would be your definition of freedom? I'm a great fan of that word and that concept. And he said, well, American democracy. I said, no, that's not good enough. Tell me, how does American democracy equate to freedom? And he said, okay, think about American democracy as sitting on top of two thick, heavy, foundational pillars. One pillar is what Murrow called the sanctity of the courts. And the other pillar he called the freedom of the press. That American democracy rests on those two pillars, a free press and a free, sacred judicial system. I argue in the book that under President Trump, the American judicial system has been weakened. When judges are called so-called judges, when the FBI is disparaged almost by the day, when the Department of Justice, which is where we are supposed to vest all of our faith in true judicial responsibility, when that is attacked as well, and when the free press is called an enemy of the public, of the people, that democracy has been weakened. I don't know to what extent. I can't read the future, but we are at a difficult time in our national lives, and we have to be honest about it and level with one another. That is the problem that we face today. How is it going to be answered? That to me is the central issue facing our nation today.
Marvin, I think a practical question that a lot of people are asking themselves is, when the Mueller report comes out, we know who's been indicted so far, and we know who's been sentenced, and we know a lot of that. But the president, obviously there's going to be some kind of reporting on him. Now, there are people who surround him who at this point have not been indicted, have not been charged with anything. Those include his kids and the vice president, all who worked very heavy on the campaign, and all who now have legal representation. Is there any chance, in your journalistic opinion, that his kids and the vice president, who headed up the transition team, knew absolutely nothing about what was going on during the campaign?
I regard that as impossible. And it has already been demonstrated to be impossible. Kushner was part of various meetings that we already know. Exactly what his daughter was doing, that is not clear. But exactly what the vice president was doing is perfectly clear, because he's out every single day on radio and television echoing what it is that the president said. Now, if it is proven that what the president has been saying has been a series of lies, and that he has been misleading the American people since the early part of the 2016 campaign, that is probably identified as a high crime and misdemeanor, which is what the Congress then has to deal with in an impeachment process. And it would seem to me that Pence would not be able to escape judgment.
Well, that becomes the question, because there is a lot of question. Would Trump make a deal? and resign so his kids would not go to prison? Would there be pardons? And we'll get Pence. Is there any way that if that does happen, that Trump has to go because of the Mueller report, that Pence could stay and become president?
It is absolutely possible that that is the case, but my feeling is, number one, I have to be very careful here. We all have to be. We do not know a lot, and we are engaging in degrees of speculation, but there is also information that is known, that is factual. And a lot of that has already come out. Let's remember that Mueller has already produced two reports. One of them focused on the technology that the Russians used in the 2016 campaign. The second, which came out about 5 months ago, focused on the Russian side, how the Russian trolled and did their thing in order to affect the 2016 campaign. What is not yet out, and that will be the heart of this third report when it does come out, is the American side of the scandal. And the American side has to be, almost by definition, those people around the president and the president himself. It will have to be the White House. It happened with Nixon in 1974, and it is very likely to be happening with President Trump in 2019. We will see that, Scott, unfold. We're not mind readers. We're journalists, and we're speculating now, but we are also passing on information that is hard and firm.
Absolutely. And there are two questions I want to get in here, because I always appreciate your time and your perspective. And there's one part of the Mueller indictments, I believe it was the second indictment, where he indicted the Russians, that has seemingly went by the wayside, and maybe you can produce an answer to this. It did talk about Facebook. It did talk about internet trolls. It did talk about, that's why they were indicting the Russian people. But there is a line, and if it's not the second indictments, it's one of the Mueller indictments that came early. There's a line in there where Mueller says he knows that 38 states' voter rolls were hacked into and thousands of people's personal information was compromised. Now, as a person, my question to that was, the idea is the Russians wanted to get in there and not let people know that they got in there. So how does he know that?
I do not know how he knows that. I do know that he's a very careful lawyer, and he was very careful when he ran the FBI, and he is being meticulously careful now, and that if that is what he said, and I know he did, we're going to learn more about that when this next report comes out. We may not know everything. We're going to know a lot more than we know right now.
And the other question, which I think is maybe the one of more high interest, we've had two impeachments in this country, Andrew Johnson, who survived
yes.
it, and Bill Clinton,
yes.
who survived it, and we
yes.
had Richard Nixon, who thought he couldn't survive it, so he left office.
Yes.
But the difference is, the crime here, and we don't know if it's true yet, but the crime is, the whole investigation is about the Trump campaign colluding with Russia to defeat Hillary Clinton. If that is proven, that the Trump campaign knew about it, or that the president himself knew about it, and Hillary's campaign was unjustly defeated, because it was a close election, you know.
Yes.
Okay. So, can people just let that go and say, well, can Hillary let that go without bringing a case and just say, well, tough luck, I have this report that says I should have won, that says something illegal happened that prevented me from winning, but I just have to live with that for the rest of my life?
Number one, I do not believe that Mueller will be coming out with anything definitive along that line. I don't think he's going to say Trump did not win that Hillary actually won, because it's almost impossible to determine that. I leave you with the thought, because I know we're running out of time now, I leave you with the thought that the cover-up is often worse than the crime. The cover-up leads to lying, leads to deceit, leads to cheating. And the cover-up in this case, as it was with Nixon, is going to end up being more revealing than what it is that the Trump people will be accused of having done. At this particular point, all of us ought to sit back, take a deep breath, and wait for the report to come out, and ease up on our perfectly natural desire to speculate on where we're going to be. We're going to be in new terrain. That is clear. This country has never been there before. How this country responds to those kinds of new challenges will determine effectively whether our democracy can survive and whether our freedoms can survive. Those are the key issues, and they are now before the American people, and we're going to find out exactly how they respond when they and we know a heck of a lot more than we know now. Thanks, Scott.
The book is Enemy of the People, Trump's War on the Press, the New McCarthyism, and the Threat to American Democracy. The author, legendary journalist Marvin Kalb. Marvin, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Marvin Kalb, one of the best. We're going to break and come back with Sam Donaldson right after this.
Really stink this time, Ed. My God. You'll be... They'll turn you off.